Ocean health is critical to human health in the long run. And one of the best ways that we can regenerate the local ecology in this area is through regenerative ocean farming.
Welcome to the Ripples of Radical Generosity podcast by Coralis, a global community of women and non-binary people making real progress on the world's to-do list. Together, we're transforming the world to become more equitable and sustainable.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Jess from the Ember Circle. I help changemakers realign their careers and reconnect to themselves. Today, I'm excited to be here with Breton from Ondine Ocean Farm and learn all about her venture. Breton, do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself before we jump in?
Yeah, I'd love to. My name's Breton. I am a first-generation regenerative ocean farmer. I live on the Klamen First Nation traditional territory of the Sunshine Coast, and I'm very, very excited to be here.
Can you tell us a bit about Ondine Ocean Farm, what a regenerative ocean farmer does, and a bit about your business?
Absolutely. Regenerative ocean farming is farming that basically, per the name, regenerates the surrounding ecology. So in particular, we farm oysters, scallops, mussels, kelp. We're introducing clams, hopefully sometime in the future. And yeah, we only grow crops that really have like a positive symbiotic relationship rather than a more punitive relationship with the surrounding environment.
Okay, cool. And what drew you into doing ocean farmer? I know you said you're a first generation ocean farmer. So curious about how you got into this work.
I think I've always enjoyed problem solving. And in the line of work that I was in before this, I found that we weren't really doing a lot of creative problem solving. And when I looked at the intersection of my passions, where I wanted my life to go, and the work that I enjoyed doing, very few of those boxes were checked by my previous employment. And then it was really like an exploration journey. You know, what did I want to do? And how was I going to tick all those boxes? And a lot of those things were like, I really wanted to live off grid, and I wanted to raise a family off grid. I wanted to be able to go to work every day with my 140-pound dog. And I wanted to focus on food security. The main push for this business actually came after the 2018 IPCC report came out. And I read that and I got very, very nervous. And I was like, I need to take actual action. I need to have a job that takes actual action. Because like I said, like, I want to raise a family and I want them to have a beautiful future that's full of magic and nature and delicious food. And it felt like I really needed to take a proactive role in making sure that that would happen for them.
Wow. I can imagine it felt risky in some way to do this. I wonder if you can talk a bit about the decision to take that leap that entrepreneurs know, but that it can be interesting to hear about how you got there.
I think a large portion of how I was able to take this was the fact that I didn't know what I didn't know. Had I known, I don't know if I would have been able to. It was a huge leap. And I went through a social impact incubator program based in Vancouver called Groundswell. And I did that because I wanted to be prepared for starting this business and stuff. And it's a great program, but almost nothing about it prepared me for starting this business. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It prepared me for writing a business plan that was accepted by the bank. And it prepared me for like that element of it, like how to set up my financial structure and things like that. But it didn't teach me how to run a chainsaw or how to drive a boat or, you know, what knots you need to be able to tie into certain things. And all those things I learned on the fly because I just had to. And had I known how much I would need to know to operate this, I don't think I would have been able to take that step. Instead, I just jumped.
Wow. What must have been this, like, I can teach myself anything is kind of like this attitude that I hear you must have had, which is really valuable, but also got you to make big leaps. I wonder if you can tell us a bit about where your business is now since you started and how things have shifted over time.
Absolutely. I think where I've gotten to now is I understand the industry a lot better and I understand how other people in this industry are operating. I'm an elected member of the BC Shellfish Growers Association Board of Directors. I meet a lot with my local community members and I understand that a lot of us are having the same issues. And my mindset is maybe sometimes too much community focused, but right now my main focus is on building assets that support community growth for a lot of the farmers. And I think that historically, the perspective has been, okay, everybody vertically integrate, and in this industry, at least, everybody vertically integrate, you buy all your own equipment, you get your own processing facility, you get your own customers, and you like, it's very competitive and like territorial. And as a result, like a lot of small scale operators don't ever really scale up their operations. And my goal over the last couple of years has really been to build community-based assets that, you know, have high value equipment that is amortized across multiple farms so that more people can have access to things that improve their efficiency, get more product to market. So this first step that we're taking this summer is, yeah, we're building a community harvest center that multiple people can use, and it will allow a lot of people to scale up their business. And then once we have multiple actors all scaled up, then next push is to try and build a local processing facility so that everybody can have market access and then go out and get their own customers if they want, or sell wholesale through the facility. And then ideally, if that model works, and it would be to scale it across the province and give more communities that are in these remote and rural locations affordable access to local markets or foreign markets. That's sort of the vision right now.
Wow. What strikes me in what you share, Breton, is that you're as much like an ecosystem builder as you are, a business owner, and really kind of building a whole platform that allows for others like yourself. I wonder if you can speak a bit more about how you developed that role that your business would play, or kind of broke out of the capitalist norm to do that.
Well, ocean health is critical to human health in the long run. And one of the best ways that we can regenerate the local ecology in this area is through regenerative ocean farming. A lot of the issues that we see in the BC coastal region is an issue called eutrophication, which is the overabundance of nutrients ending up in the water system. So that's things like agricultural runoff, fertilizer, all of those things get into the water. They cause these massive spikes in plankton growth, followed by these oxygen dead zones. Regenerative ocean farming, like kelp, helps address the issue of a lack of oxygen. It returns oxygen to the water. Oysters primarily eat nitrogen-based foods. So all that fertilizer, they pick that up really, really quickly, and they turn it into like a stable, sustainable protein source. We can farm oysters 16 times more densely than any other protein source in Canada. So like our ability to scale is huge. And what I see across the province isn't a whole bunch of farmers being invigorated by this. They're not like, okay, we've got our opportunity. We can help the environment. We can do all this stuff. I see a lot of farmers who are like, I can barely pay my mortgage. I can barely afford my car. I love oyster farming, but I've got two other jobs to support my farming habit. And to me, addressing that critical issue of like, how do we help make these farms more sustainable and more like financially stable addresses the issue of like, how do we really turn this incredible environmental engineer and let it loose and let it like really meet its maximum potential? So improving harvest capacity, improving processing capacity, all of those things really improve our ability to positively impact the environment and address this issue of eutrophication.
Like, as you're talking, Breton, it's really clear that your reason for starting this business wasn't just to kind of be able to live off grid. It's actually related to that IPCC report. It's like related to your purpose and the larger impact you want to have on the world. Really inspiring to see. And the business just like a vehicle to allow you to do that.
Yeah. All of it is about just creating a new way of being, really. And I have so many people who come out and visit the farm, and there's something very magical about the interface of the wild with the cultured, and like the wild space and the cultured food. And we're in somewhat protected areas, but like you still get to work every day with a wind on your face. And there's something about that deeply like primal human need for just like nature that this lifestyle really satisfies in myself and in others.
I love that. I wonder if you can talk now a bit about your collaborations with other Coralis ventures, like Nada and Skipper Otto or any others that you've worked with?
Absolutely. So Brian Miller from Nada has been a huge supporter from the beginning. Same with Skipper Otto, Sonia. I sell regularly through Skipper Otto, and their team has been incredibly supportive of what we're trying to do. And in the future, I'd love to see us as like sister organizations doing very similar things and building community. But yeah, we've been selling through Skipper Otto for about 2 years now. And Nada, Brianne has been a huge proponent of us. Her background in marine biology, she came out to the farm, I think the first year that I bought it, and spent a couple of weeks volunteering and just helping me set up the farm when it, you know, was still in its derelict condition. And yeah, she was an incredible supporter. You know, we've got a few things planned for the future, I think, to be able to sell out of there more frequently. It's difficult with food safe regulations to do something like a frozen oyster in like a bulk bin that people could then go pick through. Like Vancouver Coastal Health does not like that. So then it's, you know, we're trying to figure out packaging. We're trying to figure out a processing facility that has freezing capabilities. And I think we're pretty close to being able to see that through, but we just have a few more question marks to work out.
So you mentioned already how you're kind of creating this platform to allow other small scale farmers to be able to do this work. And I know on your website, you talk about autonomy being something that is really core to the way that you work with your team. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can talk a bit more about how your team works or the other folks that are in your ecosystem, I guess maybe is another way to say it.
Yeah, we've recently had a bit of a contraction in our team, but hopefully we'll expand that back out before summer and the busy season sets in. My idea has always been with like the core management structure to have everybody providing lateral capacity. I recognize my own shortcomings, and I want to know what somebody's doing, but I don't want to control what somebody's doing. So a really key thing that I look for in people coming on is like, do you feel confident in your ability to execute, particularly with things like environmental monitoring, which, you know, you need a 4-year degree to kind of build those systems. And I do not have an environmental background. So it's really been a lot about bringing on people who can provide the capacity and the shortcomings that I just can't do on my own. Another good one is operations manager. I am excellent with ideas and the sort of vision perspective. I'm not always the best with executing them. A great example of that is I used to work at this like farm store back in Alberta, and we used to get all these heirloom varieties of squash in. And so 1 year I was like, let's do a squash festival. It'll be great. And we'll try all these different squash in different way, and our customers will get to know how they all work. And this was like 10 years ago, before a lot of people were eating kombucha and acorn and delicata and stuff. And yeah, so they were like, okay, my management team was like, okay, take it, run with it. Sounds great. I forgot to market it. Nobody showed up. I completely forgot about marketing. I cooked enough squash for 300 people to show up, and I forgot to tell anybody that the event was happening. So I really rely on other people to kind of fill in those backstops for, you know, what might not necessarily be my skill set. In terms of like the broader community, I know what my strengths are, and I know I'm very good at building relationships, and I'm very good at like making connections and things like that. And I've got right now, I work with a lot of these like wild harvest guys who are very end of the road draft dodger kind of guys who have been kind of living off grid on their own for 40 plus years, who don't necessarily do well going and selling in downtown Vancouver. And I'm very good at like going to downtown Vancouver and selling their product. And so they help me out with some of the stuff around the farm, some of the more mechanical stuff that I don't know how to do. And, you know, they teach me on that, and I help them sell their product. It's really just about covering each other's blind spots, I think, and finding ways to kind of serve each other and build a more resilient industry. One thing I forgot to mention in there is that this industry, over half is over 60 years old, looking to get out in the next 10 years. And a huge part of what I'm trying to do is create a pathway for new people to come in, because like all these people, not that like I want them out, but it's just like they're getting older and it's a physical labor job. Like they need to get out and enjoy, you know, their elderly years. There's so many young people who are talking about like food insecurity and stuff. And it's like, how do we draw those two groups together?
Yeah. Oh, just, it really strikes me the like the ecosystem that you have of how you work with different people, how you see the whole web of connections and relationships between them. That's amazing. Can you tell us a bit about the land that your farm is on and how you acknowledge and work in those areas in harmony with the system? I know that's a big piece of what you do, but I'd love to hear a bit more about it.
Absolutely. So we have our on-land upland lease, and then we also have our water lease. Our upland lease has been a commercial lease since 1880. It started as a forestry lease, and then in 1920, it was a mining lease, and then it turned into a forestry lease again in the 1960s, a fish farm in the 1970s, and then the whole area around me was converted into Rockfish Conservation Area in 1992. And the owner of the fish farm at the time was given an offer by the DFO. You can either take $200,000 and get out altogether, or you can take $400,000 and turn this into a shellfish farm. So he took the $400,000. And ever since then, it's been a shellfish farm. It is an interesting area, and this is actually quite sad. The upland lease or the foreshore area is all archaeological area. There's a tiered clam garden, and the on-land lease is unfortunately backfilled and shell-midden, which I've reached out to the Klamath Nation to try and help restore that shell-midden, because there's often a lot of archaeological evidence found in them. But because the government has had possession of this land since 1880 and has been using it as a commercial site, it'll take a lot of work to kind of protect that. And I protect that in as much as I can. I try and stay out of the foreshore and not do damage to any of those archaeological sites. And I've reached out to the Klamath Nation if they want to come out and do a site inspection slash, you know, look at it for their traditional knowledge slash traditional history resources. Because really, like, this area, you can see the historical significance of it very quickly when you're on it. It's a large cleared area that's sheltered by cedar trees. It's got fresh running water and it's very clean. And it's got a huge beach that's very productive. You can very easily see how a community would settle here quite frequently. And the size of the shell midden indicates that it was used quite frequently. And I'd really love to see more of this area used by the local community, because it very much was theirs since time immemorial. So that's sort of the history of the land. And then in the ocean, we've got the fish farm that was there first. And unfortunately, the previous owner, or the previous owner, who, before he turned into a shellfish farm, he sank his fish farm. So over the last few years, we've spent a lot of money cleaning up that site and bringing up all the old nets. And that's been a really rewarding project. We partnered with the Emerald Sea Protection Society to do that. And they were able to take those nets that we were able to get off the seafloor bottom that were used for salmon pens and actually resell them, which helped pay for the seafloor cleanup, because usually that's an extremely expensive process. So that was much appreciated. And then how we tend the ocean, how we tend the products, we really try and look for symbiotic relationships. Like, one of the benefits of introducing kelp is that kelp attracts sea urchins. And we don't like sea urchins and kelp together, but sea urchins are actually very good for shellfish. They keep them clean. They eat all the biofouling off of them and stuff. And that's really, really beneficial for our oyster crop and keeping them alive. Conversely, oysters don't do well with sea stars, but the sea stars can help protect the kelp from the urchins actually getting there. So we sometimes suspend cages near the kelp so that there's like a barrier of sea stars, so that the urchins can only get so far, but they can't quite get to the kelp. It's a bit of a game and still very much a learning curve of how to properly develop all these relationships and contain them and stuff, but it's a really valuable and cool learning curve.
Yeah, it sounds like not only are you learning a lot of things of how to run the farm, there's also just like learning all these interrelationships between the different species, and can only imagine the layer upon layer of learning curve. And so I know we're both connected in Corliss, and I'm curious if you can talk a bit about, you know, why you decided to apply as a venture. What was that application process like, and how your involvement has gone so far in Corliss?
Absolutely. Brianne was a big influencer of why I decided to apply. I often find that, like, I'm applying for a lot of things, whether it's grants or this. And when talking to Brianne, she said, if you're going to put your energy into one thing, put it into Corliss. And I 100% agree. I think the application process was good in a few different ways. It really helped me clarify how I was talking to myself about the vision of the farm and helped me like really put things, like I was like, in my mind, I was like, okay, we need this equipment and we need this and we need this. And then like through that application process, it was like, actually, let's put these into terms. What are we really trying to do? We're trying to get all this equipment because really we're trying to solve the problem of like community harvesting and try and put that kind of into a bit more of a perspective and a strategic plan rather than like, you know, just chasing a bunch of things. And I appreciate the application really helped consolidate that. It was incredibly validating and humbling to be chosen. You know, there's so many incredible ventures that were out there, and it was really validating and humbling. There's so many things that I've done in the last few years that have gone unnoticed, and it just made it feel like those things that were really appreciated by more than just me. And it's really exciting to me, the idea that I will get to share my growth and the company's growth and where we go from here with a large community of supporters.
I love that. It also, you know, in our, like in a capitalist system, what gets rewarded by that isn't necessarily, I think, what we're trying to look for in ventures and like what gets rewarded in that. So I'm so glad that you felt seen and celebrated in those many, like the multiple ways that you are shifting systems in the work that you do. What's next for Ondine Ocean Farm? What's in your big dreams going forward?
So right now, our community harvest hub is looking like it's going to be online by the end of the summer, which is very exciting. We are doing a potential co-packing agreement for canned product with St. Jean's Cannery, which is the oldest cannery still open on the West Coast. So that's really exciting. And that will allow us to have like a nice shelf-stable product that we can get out into a few more stores. And right now, just really focusing on those two things. And then I think once we've got that in place, then we're going to be looking to build a proof of concept processing facility on the Sunshine Coast in the next probably year, year and a half.
Awesome. Cool. So do you have any asks for the community that you want to put out there of ways that folks can support you in your work?
I'd love to ask people to learn more about shellfish and regenerative ocean farming. I really think that like so much of the narrative around shellfish is focused so much on the luxury market. Like it's considered such a fancy food, and historically it's not. Historically, it is like the food of the working and middle class. It is the thing that kept a lot of people alive through winters and hard seasons. And it is a beautiful, sustainable food. And I'd love to see the narrative of this food shift away from being served only as a fancy appetizer and to really ask the question, how do we get it to the center of the table? Like you're coming home from work, you've got four people to feed and you want to have dinner on the table in under 40 minutes. How do we get shellfish into that conversation? That's what I want to know, because that's where we start to see really big scalable impact and where like everything that we've talked about, whether it's the environmental impact, food security, like that is where we see so much potential for growth, both as an organization and our impact.
Is there anything that I should have asked you or anything else that you want to share, want people to know?
I just once again want to reiterate, like I'm so grateful to the community and everyone I've met through it, and shout out to everybody who's doing similar things, Save the Sea, Sea Smart, Seven Leagues Leather, everybody who has their eye on the ocean and the long-term sustainability. It's really incredible to be able to connect with the Corrales community and then also connect with people who are trying to shift change in the space.
And where can folks find your shellfish? Where can they find more about your farm?
To learn more about the farm, the website is probably the best place to start, as well as our Instagram page. But our shellfish to buy right now, the only local place we're selling is through Skipper Auto. But once we have that processing facility built, then we will be selling locally, which I'm very much looking forward to, being able to get into some more local restaurants and stores and farmers markets and such.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Breton.
Thanks, Jess.
Thank you for listening to the Ripples of Radical Generosity podcast. Let us know what you thought of the episode and share this podcast with your friends. we invite you to join a global community of radically generous women and non-binary folks at www.corliss.world.